With you this week, and as I mentioned in the Bible class hour, I appreciate so much the invitation to talk to you about God and about His Word and why we believe what we believe. I've been thinking about this meeting for quite some time now, as talked to earlier about 2.5 years ago with the Don, as he called and said something quite funny to me on the phone. He said, "Well, we were wanting you to come this year," and I said, "Well, the elders at the Church of Dripping Springs, and understandably so, only let me have about 4 to 5 meetings a year, and so I won't be able to come for another 2.5 years." And he said, "Well, we might all be dead by then," he said. Well, I'm glad to know that he and you are still alive and that you're here. This congregation is not just here, but it appears to me that it's growing and thriving and that you're involved in a lot of great works. And so we appreciate what you're doing, and commend you to God and encourage you to keep on keeping on, because what we believe in and what we know to be true is something that we are going to talk about today. Peter said, "We believe and know that Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God." Our faith, as we mentioned in Bible class, rests upon evidence, Hebrews 11 and verse 1. We live in a marvelous universe. But I want us to begin by thinking about that universe by purposes of an illustration. If after our lesson today you were to walk outside of the church building and to see this large translucent ball sitting in the parking lot, I submit to you that your immediate response would be, "What is that? Where did it come from and how did it get here?" I don't think you would get in your car and say, "Well, look at there," and then just go on your way to eat your lunch. There would be an immediate investigation. But if someone said to you, "Well, I know how that got here. There were two crickets fighting over a piece of bubble gum in the parking lot. And as they began to pull and stretch and fight, this ball just sort of appeared over time." It's amazing, isn't it? It just happened because of two elements in nature sort of not really having any design or purpose in mind, but created by accident this marvelous round ball. Now, I don't know what you do with a ball like that. I don't know if anything could really even live on that ball and what its purpose would be. But I do know that there is a large ball outside of this universe that we live in, or in this universe that we live in, that is more than simply a ball suspended in space, moving at vast speeds throughout this universe, never varying more than 1/9 of an inch from its elliptical orbit around the sun, poised some 93 million miles away. As we think about this universe, having grown up in it, having lived in it, we sort of become accustomed to it, don't we? We don't tend to think so much about how it got here. What's it doing here? And who made it? Did it come about as the result of an accident, of just material things in this world sort of on a collision course, bringing about not just a ball, mind you, but a perfect living environment wherein life can be sustained and be protected from a sun that is over 20 million degrees Celsius in terms of its temperature? We just happen to live on an earth with a mean temperature of 11.1 degrees Celsius, about 58 degrees Fahrenheit. Our neighboring planet, Venus, 800 degrees Celsius. Let's go to Pluto, minus 400 degrees Celsius. Folks, we're talking about vast extremes in terms of temperature, but upon this earth that we live upon, just happens to be at the right tilt, going at the right speed, to produce exactly the right amount of time every year going around the sun, and has this marvelous sort of buffer system around it. This universe that we live upon is vastly designed and intricate. Trees, grass, a water system, mountains, There is beauty everywhere. In fact, as the psalmist said in Psalm 19, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament showeth His handiwork. Day into day, and night into night, utter His speech. There is no language where their voice is not heard. The beautiful creation, this universe in which we live, is like a musical chord that can be heard throughout all nations of the world. And just like you do not get a song without a songwriter, you do not get a beautiful musical world without a composer and a designer. Everywhere we live, God's creative power and His beauty can be seen in the changing of the seasons, in the planting of seeds. When you plant corn, what do you get? You always get corn. When you plant a watermelon seed, you always get watermelon. Now, some of you have been farming and ranching a long time. And I've been doing a little bit of farming here and there, and I've watched my grandparents farm when they were little. But never in my life did we ever plant a peach seed without getting a peach tree. I never saw corn produce watermelon. In fact, we call it the law of biogenesis. There is a law in the natural world that says whatever you plant, that's what you're going to reap. And that after its kind. A law that is revealed, yes, in the Word of God in Genesis chapter 1. That everything shall give rise or life and to that of its own. That's what we see in the natural world. We don't see apes giving birth to humans. But rather we see a natural process that has been going on that is observable by science, by the scientific method. There is natural law. You don't get laws without a lawmaker. You don't get a poem without a poet. You don't get a book without an author. And you certainly don't get a watch without a watchmaker, and you don't get a world without a world maker. It would be ludicrous for me to try to convince you that this watch simply came about as the result of an explosion in a junkyard. We look at this watch and we see how it keeps time. And even though it's designed by men and has flaws in it, it nevertheless is systematic. There's process. We understand that weather and time and elements in this world simply in an explosion somewhere could not have created something like this. No one could convince you in a million years that this could come about as a result of an accident. And yet, this watch sometimes has problems, doesn't it? But the world and the time element involved in its going around the sun, that is our earth, as we mentioned a moment ago, never varying in its orbit more than 1/9 of an inch. If it did, why, it would spin us off into the universe and we'd be way away from the sun and freeze to death. Or it might bring us even closer to the sun. I don't know if you've ever thought about the marvelous universe in which we live. And think about things, for example, how it is that poised some 93 million miles from the sun, how it is that we do not still burn up. Did you know in 2001 something very significant happened to this sun that is over 800 million degrees Celsius? It's sort of like a boiling pot. You ever watched a pot of water on the stove and it's boiling? And it's not made of water, but made of various gases that I'm too ignorant to be able to even completely explain to you. But you can go on the internet and look on various YouTube sites that were produced by NASA and others and see the sun sort of and what it looks like on the surface. It's sort of like a boiling cauldron of fire. And you know what happens in a boiling pot of water? Sometimes these little bubbles, right, they're coming up. And what do? They burst, don't they? They burst. And the water sometimes splashes over. You know the sun's doing that? The sun kind of bursts and sends these powerful energy forces throughout the universe. In 2001... NASA was observing observing the sun, and in the camera from one of the satellites, you could see an explosion took place and sent this enormous amount of energy racing throughout our galaxy. You remember when it happened, right? 2001? You remember? It got a lot hotter that day, didn't it? Oh man, everything was burned up. Unbelievable amount of energy coming hurling at our Earth. You don't remember that? I don't remember it either. Why? Because when it finally got to the Earth, what happened? That ozone, that buffer that just happens to be around the Earth, sort of like a force field, absorbed that energy and sent it around the Earth, and in that particular instance, like it does at various parts of the year, every year, at certain times when the Earth is tilted just right toward the sun, you get those beautiful northern lights, as well as those in the southern hemisphere as well. As those powerful forces of energy and heat wave comes hurling toward our Earth, it hits that ozone layer and sort of bounces back off and dissipates into the air. That's what causes those beautiful lights that people in Alaska love to see. It's a good thing we've got that ozone, isn't it? I wonder how that force field, as it were, got around the Earth. Made this just a perfect environment to live in. This Earth and its universe, it had a cause, isn't it? It had a cause. This is an effect. That ball sitting out in the parking lot is an effect. What caused it? How did it get there? I couldn't convince you that two crickets chewing on a piece of bubble gum somehow or another produced that. You'd say, no. As clumsy and as simple as that ball is, somebody would have had to design it. As we think about its curvature and the circumference and how smooth it is, we'd say something made that. What about this beautiful world and the complete and utter complexity of it in terms of its design? How did it get here? Where did it come from? You know, I think there are really only three plausible explanations for the universe and its existence. Where did it come from? Well, scientists say, and others have figured, that maybe it created itself out of nothing. It's an idea called spontaneous generation that is actually still being taught in some public schools and colleges and can be read in some textbooks. Very, very well-known idea, especially in the 19th century among scientists, to give some explanation. Because after all, you know, they would leave a piece of meat on the table. And they'd come back in their laboratories, and a few weeks later, there would be these little larvae called maggots on there. That meat spontaneously produced those maggots. And those maggots turned into flies. So things just happen like that in nature. Of course, what they didn't realize, right, was that when they were going to sleep at night or off doing some other kind of study, that flies were coming and laying their eggs on that meat. You see, there was an adequate cause for the effect of that larva on that meat. Spontaneous generation? I actually heard a professor at Texas State University say a number of years ago, well, yes, the matter is not eternal. I don't believe in God, so spontaneous generation must have happened at one time in the past. Something did create itself out of nothing. Poof! It just came about. And we're the irrational ones? Folks, when we think about the universe, is this a plausible explanation? Number two, the universe is eternal. It has always existed. Matter has always been sort of floating around this universe and the galaxies, this world that we know. This universe, the galaxy, is called Fred Hoyle's steady state theory. Or, number three, the universe is not eternal, and it did not create itself out of nothing. Rather, it was created by something or someone anterior to and superior to itself. I don't know of any other three explanations. Someone said, well, life could have been planted here. Well, where did that come from? You see, we need to go to our children and talk to them about where they came from. They said, well, I came from my mom and daddy. Well, where'd your mom and daddy come from? Well, they came from my grandparents. Well, where did they come from? Well, my great-grandparents. Well, where did they come from? My great-great-grandparents. Well, where did they come from? My great-great-great-grandparents. And we keep going back and back. Where did they come from? Well, at some point, there was the first man, the first woman. Well, where did they come from? Well, evolutionist says, well, they came from the ape world. Where did the ape come from? Well, the ape came from some sort of lower form of life. Well, eventually going back to the first single cell and the building blocks, the amino acids, and maybe some sort of gentle, warm pool of a volcano that existed, and lightning hit it, and it produced the first cell. And eventually out of that, well, where did that lightning come from? Well, we got a problem there. Where did that amino cell acid come from? Yeah, that's a problem. Where did the volcano come from? No, that's a problem too. Eventually, we've got to have some explanation as to where things came from. I don't know of any other three possibilities. First one, as we consider it, according to astronomer Robert Jastrow, he said the creation of matter out of nothing would violate a cherished concept in science. The principle of the conservation of matter and energy, which states that matter and energy can be neither created nor destroyed. Matter can be converted into energy and vice versa, but the total amount of all matter and energy in the universe must remain unchanged forever. It is difficult to accept a theory that violates such a firmly established scientific fact. You say, well, I can destroy a tree. Well, all you do is, in burning a tree, is change the energy in that tree into some other usable form, like heat. When we think about our universe, astronomer Robert Jastrow was saying that matter cannot create itself out of nothing. Well, who is Robert Jastrow? Well, he has an interesting sort of resume. Astronomer and physicist who earned his PhD from Columbia University, member of NASA's Lunar Exploration Committee, professor of Earth Science at Dartmouth, director of Mount Wilson Institute, which manages Mount Wilson Observatory in California. Quite an extensive resume. Listen to what he says. Why do some scientists believe that matter spontaneously created itself out of nothing? He says this. There is a strange ring of feeling and emotion in these reactions of scientists to evidence that the universe has a sudden beginning. They come from the heart, whereas you would expect the judgments to come from the brain. Why? I think part of the answer is that scientists cannot bear the thought of a natural phenomenon which cannot be explained even with unlimited time and money. There is a kind of religion in science. It is the religion of a person who believes there is order and harmony in the universe, and every effect must have its cause. There is no first cause. This religion, faith of the scientists, is violated by the discovery that the world had a beginning under conditions in which the known laws of physics are not valid and as a product of forces or circumstances we cannot discover. When that happens, the scientist has lost control. Consider the enormity of the problem. Science has proven that the universe exploded into being at a certain moment. It asks, what cause produced the effect? Who or what put the matter and energy in the universe? Was the universe created out of nothing, or was it gathered together out of pre-existing materials? And science cannot answer these questions. Indeed, it cannot. Because science deals with observable phenomena, the physical, the material, the empirical method. And yet God is spirit. God is mind. God is not made up of flesh and blood except for when it inhabited a human body here upon this earth in the form of Jesus Christ. Something did not create itself out of nothing. What about the second one? The universe is eternal. It's always been here. Matter has always been around. It's existed and always will exist. Well, let's listen to what Robert Jastrow says about that. Only as a result of the most recent discoveries can we say with a fair degree of confidence that the world has not existed forever. The lingering decline predicted by astronomers for the end of the world differs from the explosive conditions they have calculated from its birth. But the impact is the same. Modern science denies an external existence to the universe, either in the past or in the future. Did you catch what he was saying? That there is this state of decline. That's the law of thermodynamics. That says that we go or one of the laws of it, that says we go from a state of low entropy to high entropy. That is, we go from a state of what? Organized to unorganized. A state of that which is full-fledged to that which is deteriorating. All around us in our universe, we see that law in effect. Every time you take a drink of water out of a glass, now mind you, not a plastic glass or a solo-serve plastic glass, but a regular old glass. And every time you take a drink out of there, you know a little bit of that glass is dissolving. And over time, if you continued to do that, you would see that, what? That glass would get thinner and thinner. You buy a new car. What happens to that car? That car, over time, begins to deteriorate. That is a law that says we go from a state of organization to a state of less disorganization. That's what the Bible teaches. Whereas science says, no, we're starting off at chaos and going the other direction. Robert Jastrow says, that's not the case. Matter is not eternal. It had a beginning, he said. And now we see a gradual, slow decay of those things. Well, what about the third one? Universe is eternal, or is not eternal, and did not create itself out of nothing. Rather, it was created by something or someone anterior and superior to itself. Folks, you can't have an effect without an adequate cause. What caused this universe? How did it get here? As we observe it, we're going to see that there is design in the universe. We talk about our own human bodies having design that I'll talk about in just a moment. We talk about this world as being in a solar system. Systematic. If something is systematic, it's regular. It's dependable. We live in a systematic world, in a systematic universe. Well, young people, I want to tell you a story. A story about two little squirrels or raccoons going through the woods. What do you think? They're going through the woods one day, and as they're on their journey, it begins to get a little dark, and they come across something like that. And as they open the door to that cabin and they walk inside, they feel their feet run across a little wire. And when that little wire is tripped, the door shuts behind them. And all of a sudden, the walls begin to emit this sort of gas. And this gas begins to deteriorate their lungs and they feel sick. What do you think those young people are going to think? These raccoons are going to think when they have stumbled into this house and the door closes behind them and their body inside begins to deteriorate. Oh no! We've stumbled into some sort of trap. Someone or something designed this to catch little boys or raccoons or whatever it is. Right? We wouldn't think that those woods out there just simply sort of flew together and erected this little cabin and strung this string across it and had this special gas that came out inside of it that would choke people to death. No, none of us would ever accept that. We'd say, somebody designed it to catch things. Well, what about the Venus flytrap? Here's something from the natural world. One example among millions that we could talk about. I love watching the Planet Channel, Animal Planet. I love watching some of those shows that talk about how complex and how interesting and how well designed our universe is and the ecosystems that we live in. Interesting. When we think about the ecosystem of a Venus flytrap, a little plant that grows about to be a foot long. It has these leaves on it that are anywhere from 3 to 5 inches long. that are hinged.
And they have inside their leaf these little hair follicles.
And when a fly comes along and lands on that Venus flytrap, it triggers that little follicle, that little trip wire. And when that wire is tripped, the leaf then hinges closed quickly. And from the sides of that leaf, there are then what? This sort of gas or liquid-like material that over time begins to dissolve that fly so that the Venus flytrap can have important nutrients for its growth. All around us. Why isn't our ocean stagnant? Why will our ocean eventually be cleansed of all of its various mishappenstances that take place with human beings and oil spills down the Gulf? You go out to a pond outside of somewhere out here on your ranch, and over time, if there isn't rain or something coming into that pool, what happens? It dries up. It begins to become stagnant, and moss grows in there, and it's not fit for drinking. And after a while, things don't want to live in there. It gets really murky. Well, that's not happening with our water systems in the world, is it? As the clouds come in and they drop down rain, it goes down to the earth and brings up through wells and various other water sources and then flows into rivers back out to the sea. We've got this continual water cycle that's happening. Well, the water coming from the ocean that is evaporating into the air and producing the clouds just happens to be good, clean water. How is that the case? Because there's a constant moving of the ocean. The tides that come in and out. You set your clock by it. Books have been set by it. And people long ago, even before modern science, began to realize that it was done in connection with the sun. The sun and its gravitational pull and its reaction with our earth is what's causing those oceans to keep moving. And the fact that oceans are continuing to move is what continues to cleanse the ocean and to keep it from being stagnant. Folks, we live in a marvelous universe all around us that reflects and merits the work of a designer. Yes, so brought out in this marvelous debate in the 1970s between Brother Thomas Warren, who had a PhD in philosophy from Vanderbilt University, and debated on the right there, a man by the name of Anthony Flew from Reading University at that time. He was a renowned, at that time, atheist. By the way, he just passed away this weekend. At that time, he was a renowned atheist. He wrote books on philosophy, was the foremost, perhaps, in his field in that era, in the last 20 or 30 years. He debated Brother Warren at Denton, at North Texas State University. And I think Anthony Flew came thinking that he was going to find someone who had a better felt than told religion. But instead he found a man who reasoned from the scripture and from the natural world and came to inescapable conclusions, conclusions that could not be answered by Anthony Flew. In fact, in this hallmark debate, I want you to understand that Dr. Warren asked an important question about the human hand. And parents, all you got to do is remember this right here, attached to your hand, to teach your children about the existence of God. He asked Mr. Flew, he said, "Mr. Flew, tell me, this human hand, how did it get here? Where did it come from? Was it designed or did it come about as the result of an accident?" And then he spoke about a prosthetic hand, an artificial hand. This hand that is artificial It can do all kinds of marvelous things and things that have been done and designed over the years that has taken intelligence to create something like this. And we know that this mechanical hand or this prosthetic hand might look like a hand in some ways, has the ability to even pick up something like a communion tray. And yet as we think about the complexity and the design of the prosthetic hand, we ask the question, where did the prosthetic hand get its idea? From the human hand. What's the prototype of a prosthetic hand? The human hand. But friends, if we were to compare the two and think about the human hand and what it can do, it is the most gifted scientist. If the most gifted scientists cajoled their brains, they probably could not come up with a stronger or more perfect tool for grasping and delicate manipulation than the human hand. And seen from an engineering standpoint, the loveliest hand actually is a highly complex mechanical device composed of muscle, bone, tendon, fat, and extremely sensitive nerve fibers capable of performing thousands of jobs with precision. Today's Health, published by the American Medical Association. What's that? The hand is capable of performing thousands of jobs with precision. You can work on something as minute as unscrewing the lever or the screws on your watch band to picking up a large jackhammer. All kinds of skillful things can be done with a human hand. And yet we ask the question, where did the prosthetic hand get its idea? From the human hand. And yet the prosthetic hand is vastly inferior to the human hand, is it not? While the prosthetic hand, if you were to cut it, I don't think it would heal itself, do you? You'd have to go to its maker. You cut this hand? Interesting, isn't it? It can heal itself. And I'm thankful that we have in our bodies just about two of everything. So if I lose this one, I still got this one. I lose hearing in one ear, I've got this one. I lose a foot, I still got another foot. I lose a kidney, I've got another kidney. One lung, I got another lung. On and on and on we go. Think about this as we conclude our lesson this morning. Dr. Warren asked Anthony Flew, which one of these came about as the result of design and planning and thought? And which one came about as the result of an accident? No thought. It just simply evolved over time. Anthony Flew refused to answer that question throughout the course of that debate because he knew he would look foolish, because as an atheist, he would have to say that this one over here, the prosthetic hand, that is vastly inferior to this hand, the prototype, this one came about as a result of design and planning, intelligence, but this one didn't. Folks, it boggles the human mind. On one level, we can see design everywhere in the things that we drive, in the clothes that we wear, in the buildings that we build. But who built this universe? The Bible describes this universe as a house, as a tabernacle to be lived in. Who built it? Oh, yes. Psalm 139, verses 14 through 15 says, I will give thanks unto you, Jehovah, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works, and that my soul knows right well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and curiously wrought in the lowest part of the earth. Think about this. Psalm 139, verses 14 through 15, the lowest part of the earth is an idiom which means in the womb. Curiously wrought is a Hebrew term meaning woven or embroidered. In Exodus 23:36, the same Hebrew word was used to describe the beautifully embroidered curtain of the tabernacle. God says, you are beautifully made. You're designed. Several years ago, my dad was in the hospital fighting for his life. They'd removed one of his kidneys, and in recovery, one of the sutures, or the suture, broke, and he began bleeding inside. He went into respiratory arrest. They rushed him into the hospital. I rushed him into the emergency room, back in there in the operating room, and they opened him up, and the doctor literally put his finger on the open hole and held it until they could get him stabilized, until they could re-sew it. His fight wasn't over. Lost all that blood, they began to put new blood into him, but new blood isn't as good as the blood that's been in your body working for a while, so you need all of those hemoglobins, and you need those platelets. And so they began putting plasma into you. It doesn't clot as well. It takes a little time. He still was bleeding and bleeding. Within the space of 24 hours, he lost over 30 units of blood going inside of his body. Thankfully, he was stabilized, got him off the ventilator, eventually got to his own room. I'll never forget the day he showed me as he pulled his gown over a little bit, and his entire side of his body was completely dark blue. And we said, "Doctor, what happened? Did you bruise him when you opened him up?" He says, "Oh no. That's the blood inside of his body that he was losing. And the body is absorbing it." And what's happening? It's breaking it down. It's reusing it. And it's making new blood. That's what our hematologist told us. You guys know of an engine that can take oil, spill it all over the engine, absorb it back into the engine, break it down, and make new oil out of it? If you could, and you could design it, you'd be a rich person. And everybody would call you the most intelligent engineer they'd ever run across. And yet our body, with all of its systems, the endocrine system, the skeletal system, the muscular system, the cardiovascular system, unbelievably complex. We are in fact evidence, our bodies, of an all-creative, intelligent designer in this universe. But as we conclude this lesson, I want you to think about this. Psalm 95 reveals to us, and I hope you'll read it today, because the Lord is the creator of this universe, we must therefore bow down and worship Him. Let us kneel before our Maker in humble submission. We ought to live in adoration at the world that we live in and the bodies that we have. Some people say, "Well, you know, but our bodies are breaking down and I don't see as good as I used to and I have to wear glasses and all that." Well, you know, that's a part of the design of the world that we live in. Human pain and suffering often creates greater and important values. But the fact that maybe our eyes aren't as good as they used to be, and when I hit 40, let me tell you, I had to start wearing these. Unbelievable. Well, I guess God just wasn't a very good designer. Well, how do we know, number one, it's not a part of His purpose for us to grow older? We know that it is. But secondly, the fact that something may be deteriorating does not remove the fact that it has design. Last illustration. Next Saturday, let's say you have a work day up here, and all of you gather up here on Saturday morning, and there's a big pile of leaves that have been sitting back there behind the church building that have been just sort of in the way, and someone says, "Well, you know, I want to take that home for my garden. That'd be great mulch. Wouldn't it be great garden material?" So they start digging it up and throwing it up and digging it up and throwing it up. And you know what? At the bottom of that pile, they find a textbook that belonged to Don. You say, "Well, that's an old textbook." Not really. But you look at that textbook, and it's in a state of decomposition, isn't it? The edges are all worn. The pages are yellow. Things have been eating at it. But the fact that it's in a state of decomposition and deteriorating doesn't mean that it didn't have an author. Doesn't mean that it didn't have a designer who laid out the pages and put the printed words in there. You see, yes, our bodies wear down. But it's according to God's divine purpose as we grow older, as we get ready for heaven. But secondly, it still nonetheless merits and reveals design. What do you think you would owe to someone who designed for you a wonderful house to live in, gave you food to eat, a nice environment to live? Do you think that you would owe any words of thanks to someone who gave you something like that? Any appreciation? Would you feel compelled to take care of what they had given you? Would you feel some sense of indebtedness to this individual? Let me tell you, not only did God, our Heavenly Father, create this world for us to inhabit and to live in and to enjoy, but He also went one step further, and that is that not only did He secure for us a physical environment for enjoyment and for preparation for heaven, but also secured for us our spiritual and emotional well-being in a plan of salvation to bring about His Son Jesus to die on the cross, to atone for the sins of the world, and to make them possible. You're being reunited with God, reconciled to Him, when you by faith are baptized in the watery grave of baptism, coming up out of that water, becoming a part of the church of Jesus Christ, then walking in a new life, living for Him, thanking Him every day, and saying, God, apart from You, I could do nothing, and we would have nothing. God, I love You so much. Have you forgotten about God and what you owe to Him and what He's given you every day? The very breath that you breathe, the air that you breathe. Paul in Acts 17 on Mars Hill said this, the One in whom we live and move and have our very being. We are the offspring of God. Seeing that we are the offspring of God, we ought not to think of God in terms of idols, four-footed beasts, and things like that, but rather the times of this ignorance God has overlooked. But He now commands everyone, everywhere, to repent, because there's coming a day in which He will judge the world. Are you ready for the judgment? God has given you time. I hope that the time doesn't run out on you. Make your life right today as together we stand and as we sing.